This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network podcast. My name is Joanne Kwai. I'm a PhD candidate studying media and communication at Karlstad University in Sweden. Today, I'm delighted to be talking to Dr. Maria Wiemers. She's an assistant professor in cybersecurity and politics at Maastricht University in the Netherlands and currently a core fellow at the Helsinki Collegium for Advanced Studies, where she researches internet freedom and the human rights implications of internet policy and platform governance, in particular in authoritarian states. She's also one of the editors of the Paragraph Handbook of Digital Russia Studies, published open access last year. The book presents a multidisciplinary and multifaceted perspective on how the digital is simultaneously changing Russia and the research methods scholars use to study Russia. We'll be talking about this book and some other interesting research Maria has been doing. Maria, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So to begin with, can you tell us a little bit of your background? What have you been doing and what has led you to your current research interests?
Well, I've always had a fascination with how collectives or groups of people come to believe certain things. So especially, of course, where I've been specializing mostly in Russia. So that is also how does the state control the information space? How does it control what people think, whether they approve of the government or not? So this has been the core of my fascination for quite some time. I started off in quite different topics, so more the traditional media sphere, Russian television, Russian cinema. So how all of these forms of mass communication are used to promote certain understandings of politics. So how can you, for example, use historical references to make the claim that Russia has always been this great state and that it needs a strong leader and so on. So that was my initial topics that I focused on. So more these uses of history, memory politics, and how that intersects with cultural policy, with policies affecting press freedom. That was more for my PhD. But since then, I've moved quite steadily towards the digital, since also Russian restrictive measures have also moved to the digital. So initially, they targeted mostly television, newspapers, like all of these mass communication channels, and the internet was more or less unregulated or very limitedly. But that has changed massively over time, and I've kind of moved along with the Russian government and what they have been focusing on. So trying to study what do they do, what are the different tactics that they use, how successful are they, but also the other way around. So how successful are Russian citizens, Russian opposition leaders, Russian activists, and actually still trying to shape that information space, coming up with new tactics and so on. So it's really about this competition and shaping information flows, shaping what you can say, what you cannot say. And as a result, of course, then the end point tends to be to try and influence how the audience at large thinks.
You've already painted a nice background to introduce the book, Digital Russia Studies. As you are one of the editors, can you tell us a little bit, how did the book come into being?
It actually emerged from a collaboration that I had with one of the other co-editors, Daria Gritsenko. So at the University of Helsinki, where we were both at that time, so at the Aleksanteri Institute for Russian East European Studies, we found out we had quite similar interests. So we both were very interested in digital politics, but also in promoting digital methods for studying Russia. And we thought it would be good to get a little bit more attention for that, because we noticed that this was very much spread out. So you would have internationally individual researchers doing research on related topics, but they were not necessarily connected to each other. So we came up with this seminar series to try and invite speakers to talk about all these very diverse topics, just to share knowledge and share skills, and also very more methodological skills. And at some point we thought, well, this actually is picking up. So people were interested. We got the network was growing. We found out that there was quite some demand. So we decided, well, would it not be nice to then turn that into a book? So have something very concrete where you do the same thing. So where you try to combine, on the one hand, how is digitalization changing Russia? So all of the different aspects that you would have in, let's say, the areas that is approached to Russia. So Russian economy, government, culture, arts, religion, all of those. So how is digitalization changing those? But at the same time, to combine it with chapters that are about data sources. So what kind of new digital sources do you have? How is that changing how we study Russia? And then also part about methods, because they tended to be very separate. And we wanted to actually bring them all together to then promote that people also read across those divides. And we teamed up with a third editor, Mikhail, who's a linguist, also at the University of Helsinki, to make sure that we had all of the different backgrounds that we needed to actually do the book. So we can go all the way from humanities, since I also have part background in humanities, through all of the social sciences into more linguist approaches, working with large corpora of text, for example, so that we were able as editors also to manage such very, very diverse topics and make sure that they were all on the level of quality that we wanted to have for the book. So it really emerged this collaboration very naturally. But of course, at some point, you then understand how big this thing is that we started. It was quite a lot of work, but at the same time, I think it's also quite a unique resource, and I'm very happy that it's out there and that it's now also finding its audience.
Yeah, that sounds really fascinating and definitely a timely contribution. And you also wrote one chapter in that book, The Digitalization of Russian Politics and Political Participation. So to talk a little bit about that chapter, how has digitalization or technology in general changed Russian politics?
And so what I do in the chapter is that I look at the different aspects of politics and try to understand what has digitalization done there. So has it changed something fundamentally? So has it changed, for example, the character of politics? Or is it just that now it's done by different means? So it's the same thing, but now it's digital. So because it can be either way, right? It can be that your campaigning style, for example, is completely revamped because you now use digital tools. You now do use different kinds of targeting. Or it can be that you used to have a poster, now you have a website. So that was more or less the idea behind the chapter, to look at the different areas and try to see to what extent has something fundamentally changed. So I look at political communication. So for example, how over time Russian politicians started using social media. And also at some point, it was governmental policy that also local representatives had to do it. So all of the governors, for example, were forced to have their online presence and to use these communication channels. So that's one dimension, seeing the changes there. Another one is more about campaigning, which of course is an area where you also, which is interesting, because it also affects the actual electoral outcomes. So if you now adopt new campaigning strategies that are digital, that are very useful, that turn out to be effective, then that at that point could still affect electoral outcomes. So that's another one. And then voting, of course, so the actual systems used. So for example, recently they've been using electronic voting, and also more recently even online voting, which of course is also, there's quite some risk of fraud. we could talk more about that. And then finally, of course, also things like civic engagement. So how does it also affect more local level government? You also had some initiatives like participatory budgeting, so that on a very local level, the citizens of particular neighborhoods, for example, could co-decide on how a part of the local budget was spent. So we go through all of those different domains and trying to chart over time what has happened. And if you read it back now, it's actually quite interesting to see just because there's this arch where initially there is very little. So, of course, digitalization is seen as an opportunity for economic growth, first and foremost. But at some point under Medvedev, there is an actual very strong open government movement. So the idea that all ministries should publish all of their decisions. Even just last week, I was watching a discussion in the local parliament of Moscow, so Moscow City Duma, about their video surveillance systems. So I was watching it on YouTube. And this is a result of these open government policies from the 2010s. So the fact that these kind of things need to be open, that they need to be accessible, which is, of course, now very strange because we now are in the opposite arch where everything is closing down again. So over the past 20 years or so, you really see on the one hand that everything is modernizing. There has been an actual improvement in terms of governmental services to citizens using all kinds of digital platforms. But at the same time, we're now on the opposite arch where everything is restricting again, where we are moving in the opposite direction. So where digital tools are used mostly to repress, to control, and much less to offer services to citizens.
And I understand that you also studied internet policy and also algorithmic governance in the Russian context, such as in your articles of the banning of the messaging app Telegram and also the Russian state's law on regulating news aggregators, those ones powered by algorithms. So what is so special about the Russian approach to algorithmic governance or the control of these platforms?
I think the most different has been two things. So first of all, if you so when we think about authoritarian states, then usually we think of China. And China has developed its internet in isolation, more or less, from the global internet. And they also have a very large market. So that means that there are domestic companies, domestic platforms, everything can be done in-house, so to say. This, of course, also affords quite an extensive level of control. In Russia, the opposite is the case. So the Russian internet develops fully integrated with the global internet. So, for example, you have these very large domestic companies such as Yandex, which you can think of as the Russian Google, more or less. They even launched their search engine before Google did. So that's how far back it goes. They have all of these different conglomerates of media services. And at the same time, so contrary to China, international companies were active there. So it was a mixed market where on the one hand, you had very well-developed domestic internet sector, very well-developed platforms, many of them also more popular than the international ones. So, for example, when you think about social media, then the domestic one, VK, which used to be known as ВКонтакте, it was more popular than, for example, Facebook. So that made it very interesting that it's this very mixed market of, on the one hand, very strong national competitors, at the same time, foreign competitors were still in the same market. And it also developed quite freely up until a certain point. So up until, we usually take 2012, 2013 as the turning point when there were very large-scale protests in Moscow as well as other cities against electoral fraud in the parliamentary elections. And these are very, very large protests, the largest ones that had been there since the disintegration of the Soviet Union. And at that moment, it was understood that social media played quite an important role, so as a facilitatory role, in organizing those protests. So to build new collectives, to have people know that there is a protest, to call on others to also join the protest and so on. So this really, it alarmed the Russian government, where they thought we now have to switch gears. So we will no longer, as they had done before, they tried to influence online discourses. So for example, by paying bloggers, also to some extent using bots. We've seen some early evidence of that as well. So they used to be quite unique in that sense, that they were more on that end, so not trying to restrict, not trying to block websites, but just trying to influence those online discourses. But this moment in time, it changed it. So now it was seen as a fundamental threat. It's also argued that the internet is a US invention, and therefore protests can never be natural. They're always instilled by this outside power. So it's always foreign agents, always foreign interference, and they use social media to do it. So this was the turning point where the internet policy really changed. So that's also when legislation was changed to make it possible to block websites, for example. And since then, that has expanded. So they shifted gears first, blocking some websites. For example, also the website of oppositionist Garry Kasparov, the famous chess player, for example. One of his website was also blocked around that time. But over time, of course, how people consume information, how they consume news, this also shifted. So not just websites, but more and more through these aggregators. So for example, that people would go to this news aggregator, Yandex News, Yandex Novosti, and to see there, what is the main news? What are the main headlines? And this would still aggregate all of the news sources. So it would have all different kinds of news, including also, which was very uncomfortable for the Russian government, foreign news in Russian. So for example, during Russia's war against Georgia, 2008, Yandex News would also show Georgian news in Russian. Same for annexation of Crimea and the start of the war against Ukraine, 2014. Yandex Novosti would include Ukrainian sources in Russian. And this really started a big, big struggle between the government and between Yandex, as well as some other news aggregators, because they wanted to see how does this work. This cannot be. You cannot promote the sources of the enemy. And this then in the end resulted into legislation to actually make sure that this can never happen again. So connecting it to the licensing. So now they could only show media that actually has a license in Russia. So it's really that the regulatory efforts, they follow in a way the way that people consume information. So it's very reactive in a way. So when they see that the problem, so-called problem, is emerging, then they have to respond. And you see this happening all of the time.
And I see a lot of similarity to the Chinese approach as well, as I'm studying news aggregator in China. Do you see these two regions somehow comparable in terms of internet governance?
I think they are comparable in the sense that the general approach, what they seek to achieve, that of course has many similarities. So both of them want to strengthen their regimes. Both of them recognize the importance of information, but still up until 2 years ago or so, I think for Russia, it has been pushing towards what they call like digital sovereignty. So trying to become independent, have their own domestic like software and hardware and not be dependent on foreign suppliers, but also pushing out these foreign competitors, pushing out these nasty foreign social media companies that they cannot force to censor. But this has been a very long and difficult process because the Russian internet developed in a way that was so interwoven with the global internet that actually this turned out to not be really possible. At the same time, what we also long believed was that they didn't want to annoy the Russian consumer too much. If you block a website, then this really disrupts things. If you block a platform, even more so. And this, we think, has long been like an impediment. It's that as long as a platform did not cause that much political problems, as long as they could solve it in other means, then they would leave it be. So also within what we call digital authoritarianism, so studies of how authoritarian states use digital technologies, this is also understood as one mechanism through which you can actually monitor public debate. So it allows you to know what is going on, and it also allows citizens to vent, so to actually vent their frustrations. And therefore, the theory is that this could then be used to prevent larger scale unrest from actually occurring. So that if you allow some degree of freedom of speech, if you allow some degree of public debate, if you manage it in ways that are not felt as censorship by citizens, then this might actually be beneficial for regime stability. So that was long been the idea. But of course, now everything is different. So since 2 years or so, the Russian regime has become very openly authoritarian. There's no doubt about what is going on. So this the hardening really has coincided with the poisoning of Alexei Navalny, Then, of course, he was being treated in Germany and then returned to Russia, after which he was arrested and there were again very, very large-scale protests. And this is really the moment when everything hardened even more, where there's no more discussion. And of course, especially now with Russia's war against Ukraine, we have moved on to even more severe territory where even very popular international platforms are now banned. So for example, Instagram was very, very popular in Russia and also very much ingrained in everyone's life. So your local hairdresser would have an Instagram and use it to talk to your clients, but also your local governor would also have their Instagram account. So it is very much ingrained in just everyday practices as well as just day-to-day economic transactions as well. And in this case, what they did was that they actually gave what I call an eviction notice. So they said 2 days in advance, Instagram will be blocked. Please prepare. Please make sure to transfer your users to whatever platform you like. But we suggested you move it to these ones, which was, in a way, a very interesting moment where you see that this massive, massive million audience suddenly had to move. It looks like this did not really cause as much stress as you might have anticipated. But of course, we are now speaking about a situation of war where there's very open repression, where there is a very high level of censorship. So of course, this also really dampens the potential for any protest activities. Also because all of the societal infrastructures for protests have also been disbanded over the past few years. So you do see that what they might have feared before, so that blocking an international platform leads to resistance, that did not really appear to materialize on this case.
Just out of curiosity, what kind of apps did they suggest when they asked people to move away from Instagram?
So most of all, they said that you have to go to VK, so to go to ВКонтакте. And to some extent, also Telegram, because Telegram has been very large in Russia, even though they tried to ban it for 2 years between 2018 and 2020, which was unsuccessful. But then it was unbanned again, which is still a very mysterious case. But that is also very big. So if you look at the actual numbers, so audience growth around that time, you do see some audiences mostly moving to those two platforms. And of course, some also to this other Russian platform called Одноклассники, which is a bit smaller and different kinds of audience. But those are the most prominent ones. Yeah.
But I thought they will ask people to move to some platforms where the Russian government has more control of. Doesn't seem necessarily the case.
For VK, yes. So VK is very much state-controlled. So that is a Russian platform that was originally founded by the Durov brothers, who also afterwards founded Telegram. And the current consensus is that they were forced out in 2014 because they did not want to share user information with the Russian security services. At the same time, of course, we do not know the details of this. We do not know how exactly this happened. But since then, it has been part of this larger group called Mail.ru Group, which was at that time owned by a very famous oligarch called Usmanov. So this is very, very close to the Kremlin. This VK has been very, very much stayed in line for a very long time. Mm-hmm. We also know that from court cases, for example, that a lot of prosecutions are done on the basis of people's activities on VK. So this is very much a very state-loyal platform. And I would say now even more so, since this entire company is now run by the son of Kirienko, who is basically part of the very close-knit circle around Putin himself. When we speak about VK, then this is definitely very state controlled. For Telegram, it is all a bit more murky. So as I said, it's also it was started by the Durov brothers. They had a very long history. So ostensibly, this was done to prevent state surveillance. So to protect your communications from state surveillance. But we also know that, of course, Telegram has been popular with all kinds of audiences, so also very extremists. We around 2015-2016. You had ISIS propaganda, which also was very prominent on Telegram, or Telegram was much used in those circles. So they have a very long, intense history with all kinds of governments, where this idea of all information should be free, of course, also brings in all of the dark sides of online communications. And for Russia, they blocked it for 2 years, also because they said it is being used by terrorist organizations to organize attacks, since Russia has quite some history with terrorist attacks. At the same time, we do have some mixed feelings about the ban, because at that time, it was also really emerging as an alternative platform for news. So this was the platform that was being used by the opposition. It was being used by activists. It was being used by news organizations. It was used as where to spread the gossip about what is actually happening in the Kremlin. So it was becoming a very, very influential news source, which, of course, means that we also have to view it as at least being a double decision, that it might have served two ends at the same time. But the fact that now it is still allowed, it is even actively used, it also means that we have to be aware how the Russian government itself is also using it for promotional means. So they use this as a means to share propaganda. We see very influential military channels on Telegram at the moment, for example. And we know that quite many of them have at least been co-opted, if not created, by the Russian state and its affiliates. So this means that for Telegram, we always have to view it as this very very murky kind of communicator that on the one hand really espouses these ideas about almost libertarian ideas about information freedom and being anti-state repression and so on. But at the same time, we also know that they give way to all of this more state propaganda, infiltration of channels, and so on. I'm always quite critical of Telegram because it's really difficult to pinpoint what is going on. They also communicate very little; they're very closed. So it's very difficult to assess really what they do and what their intentions are.
Yeah, and sometimes when I look at Russia, and I cannot help but comparing it to the Chinese context and how the Chinese government is controlling its digital space, right? So their approach is more like the Chinese approach is more like, let's build a great firewall, and then the Chinese citizens don't have access to any of those apps or websites such as Google, Facebook, Instagram. And I've always been curious about how the Russian state managed to, through the process of digitalization, still being integrated to the international internet development. Why they made that choice in the beginning? Why didn't they choose to shut off? And how did they manage to do this? But as you already mentioned, it seems like already taken the turn. So what is going on there?
I think it fundamentally has been a very different decision at the beginning. So perhaps also at the level of the president, at least, not fully realizing what it actually is. So one of the things that you might not realize is that Putin, as it is being alleged, never actually uses the internet. So he only gets printouts of stuff. So this, of course, may have also influenced initially, at least, the way that he perceived it. Even though in public statements, he's been very suspicious of it because of its American ties. At the same time, Medvedev at that time was seen as this revolutionizer. So he also went to the headquarters of Twitter to make his Twitter account. And he's been very active in all kinds of social media. So really being seen as the president that will take Russia into this new age. So this also brought then, so this is really the period from 2008 to 2012, the idea that, well, maybe Russia is turning in a different direction. Maybe it is opening up. Maybe it is modernizing in this way. Even though under the surface, of course, many of the same structures were not actually changing. So it has been really, really about economic growth, the opportunities for economic growth and development. But also if you think about the scale of Russia, then, of course, digitalization is also excellent for education. So you have these far remote regions improving health services. Well, this is where digital can really help you, improving education, same thing. So you should really see it as partly like being quite pragmatic, that it can really help improve the way that the state runs. At the same time, it was also thought to improve things like actually collecting your taxes, because corruption, not paying taxes, this has been a problem in Russia for a very long time. We know this goes all the way to the top, but of course the top doesn't mind as much about their own corruption and about their own not paying taxes, but they do mind about the lower levels. So they want all businesses to at least pay their taxes. And this is also where digital platforms have really helped. So their own the tools and services that they've built to improve, for example, how the tax office works. So it's really been like self-interested. But still, the idea usually was that knowledge exchange, integration, this is beneficial. So many people working in those areas, this was their orientation. And because the internet sector itself and the way that the internet worked and the spaces for communication, to a certain extent, the Russian platforms, especially when we think about the information space, they were really popular. So that also maybe has lessened the felt need to intervene. So when you think, for example, about search engines, then Russia always had multiple search engines available at the same time. It still does. So you could use either the Yandex search engine or you could use the Google search engine. But to work with Russian language and Russian searches, the Russian one actually is much better because it has been tailored to that, because Russian is fundamentally different just in terms of the actual script that it uses, but also the grammar. So you would actually have better results. So it's a better product. So the domestic product for a very long time was better. And this then, of course, keeps users on that one. And it's only if you really want to, then you would use the other one, perhaps. Yeah, even though if we now do research, we find massive differences between if you would use the Google search engine or if you would use the Yandex search engine, because the Yandex one, it has followed Russian legislation much more than the international one. So it's really multi-dimensional, multifaceted how it has developed over time, where you see these multiple tendencies, some of them pulling towards more openness, pulling towards making the most of this of globalization, making the most of like these improvements. But at the same time, you have this opposite tendency coming from the political side about gaining and maintaining control, limiting opposition, trying to keep things as small as possible. So the logic for a long time appears to have been that as long as things are small enough, so as long as you do not reach that big of an audience, then it can exist. If you become too popular, if you become too big, then it needs to be. Then we need to do something about it. You've seen this also with Navalny, that when it was still small enough, it was fine. When they were building an entire network of local headquarters, and they turned out to be quite successful in pushing change in elections, then, of course, it becomes a very different matter and we need to do something about it. And that's what we've seen happening.
And you've touched upon this briefly, but something we cannot not talk about will be what happened in February this year when there's the escalation of the Russian-Ukraine war. And since then, what has changed in Russia studies, or what has changed for you, for your research?
So many things have happened since Russia's invasion of Ukraine this year. Of course, first of all, you have to do the very practical things where all collaborations between especially European institutions, so European universities and other public institutions and Russian institutions can no longer happen. So if you would have a joint research project, for example, all of those have to be cancelled. You cannot transfer money to anyone in Russia. So if you would normally work with, for example, a local researcher to do certain tasks, then those things can no longer be done. At the same time, you also cannot go there. So you cannot actually do field work as you might have done in the past. So for example, in the past, I've also done interviews in Moscow. You would not be able to do that now. Same holds, of course, for people who do archival research. So if you have archives that are only available in Russian archives, then that, of course, also is much more difficult now. But at the same time, it just affects all different kinds of disciplines. So for me right now, it is still quite okay because I work a lot also with policies. And as I mentioned, Russia has made those digitally available. So I can still consult all the laws. I can still consult how, for example, the Russian parliament debates certain legislation. But at the same time, that might also change. So it might be that they actually close down that access. So it's quite risky in that sense as well. But it affects, of course, more people who actually work with Russians on the ground, so to say. So if you would do field work, if you're an anthropologist, for example, that is much more difficult. Also the ethical issues involved there. But also if you would do surveys. So a lot of the political science research relies on surveys. And this used to be quite good. They used to joke as well that like Russia is the most accessible authoritarian country. So it's the best one. If you want to study something, you can study Russia. Because you could still pay for one of the local pollsters that was independent, Levada, to conduct these surveys. And they would actually be quite good. But of course, now it's very different. First of all, you can no longer pay Levada. So you cannot pay them. Even though in Russia, they're also seen as a foreign agent. So you have this very double situation where they cannot exist in Russia, but we also cannot pay them from the outside. But at the same time, you also have to question how reliable these surveys still are, since we now have such a high level of censorship, so much repression, where you can be prosecuted for expressing your opinion, and as well as basically stating anything that is true about the war. This can get you prosecuted. You cannot speak about the actual activities of the Russian army. You cannot speak about the atrocities that they are committing. This is all outlawed. You can also, people are encouraged to also report on each other when they make these kinds of statements. So this, of course, means that when you think about a survey where you ask people about their opinions, then you cannot expect them to answer openly. You have to be really, really careful in interpreting those kinds of results. And you might also ask, to what extent can you still do this? Are you also putting these persons at risk? So, for example, if we would want to know what is the level of support for Russia's war against Ukraine, this, of course, is very sensitive. So how will people respond? And some researchers are still trying to push forward. So trying to see, well, if we do it differently. So, for example, if you do not ask people directly, but you do it indirectly, or you allow them to choose multiple options so that they do not have to declare that openly, that you can then still get some meaningful results. But at the same time, this is really a big blow to how many people have studied Russia for a long time. So it's both on the more collaboration level, so no longer being able to collaborate with Russian scholars, but also in how you actually access data, how you have to interpret the things that you find. Things have become much more complicated. But if I just think about the handbook that we edited, if you look through the authors, you'll see that we actually made an effort to make sure that we included as many Russian scholars as possible. So the scholars that we know that do like good academic work. So we really made an issue of trying to include them. At the same time, now that would be very much more difficult. First of all, actually being associated with me could put them at risk, for example, because they are not then collaborating with Western scholars. Moreover, of course, I'm a Western scholar who researches very nasty things, right? I'm a very critical scholar in many ways. So in my engagement with Russian scholars who are still in Russia, is that I'm very hesitant now because I know that I can put them at risk. So we would no longer be able to pull something off like this. He would no longer be able to actually do it because he cannot work with Russian scholars in the same way, which of course is very sad, which is and also moving forward. It is very sad that we can no longer have these kinds of collaborations, both because institutionally we are not allowed to. So of course, informally you can have contact, but nothing that is formal. But at the same time, of course, that also means all kinds of personal relationships that people have built over time, that those are also under a lot of stress. So it's quite a big blow for Russian studies. We have to see how to move forward. At the same time, of course, people find solutions. But but what I worry most about, so this is actually perhaps a connected issue, is that for research, we often also use journalistic coverage. So to just like know what is going on. So for example, I do a lot of research on the Russian IT sector. And just to stay abreast of what is happening, I rely on Russian journalism quite a lot, because especially for tech policy and so on, and the developments in Russian business, this used to be quite good. So you can follow that and see what is going on, find some trends and identify things that you want to then research, so to then delve deeper into. But because Russian journalism, especially independent journalism, has come under so much stress. So all independent journalists, media have been blocked. Pretty much all independent Russian journalists are abroad, working in exile. This now means, of course, that this also comes under pressure. It's very difficult for them to still do their work, to still report on Russia, to work with local sources, to perhaps try and pay a local journalist who's still active in Russia. So this, of course, also on the longer term is a limitation for us as well, that we also lose this additional way of accessing things that are happening on the ground.
Mm-hmm. I was actually going to ask you another question about the main challenges that the Russian studies scholars have been facing, but you've already named so many in terms of methodology or even access to data, to political risk, and even the empirical materials that we can collect. And you mentioned, you know, looking for a way out or solutions. Is there any silver lining on all of this? Like, what can we do? And maybe what are the aspects that we can pull or we should pull our scholarly attention to, especially now in these kind of circumstances?
Well, what I think is, it's of course challenging in many ways at the moment, because it is, so in my case, I've been basically following this decline of Russian, especially in the domains that I focus on, so press freedom, internet freedom. This has really been a story of decline, so just building repression, which on the one hand, I think also makes it very important to study. At the same time, of course, it is not... It does not inspire you with enthusiasm necessarily, right? And especially when it becomes more and more hard. So you can imagine that moving forward, this also becomes a less attractive field to actually work in. So if you just think about students now who might choose to learn Russian, but can never go to Russia, that might also be an impediment. That might actually mean that less students now learn Russian. And if less students learn Russian, then they also cannot work with Russian sources, for example, which I think is for many fields very essential, that you're able to access materials in their original language. But these, of course, are longer term things, but it might change the field as a whole. So, of course, there's a lot of political interest. There's a lot of interest in trying to make predictions where it might go. At the same time, this really pushes towards the hard sides of social science. So really international relations, security, and so on. While at the same time, we also know that it's very important to understand like the actual societal, how society is bound together, how it works, how it operates, how culture works. We see that all throughout the past months. We've seen how important it is, the way that the state communicates, how it tries to legitimize what it's doing, how it's trying to intimidate its citizens. I was trying to justify the extent of the repression it does. And this is very much in the realm of what we would say is humanities. Mm-hmm. So I think moving forward, this might create some issues. Would you still be interested in actually studying the state that is doing these kinds of things? Mm-hmm. Personally, I find it quite difficult sometimes. I've studied quite a lot of Russian propaganda also for my PhD. And it's very difficult to actually study that. If you now, there has been a colleague at the University of Helsinki, Margarita Zawadzka, she, together with several PhDs, they studied Russian propaganda around the elections. And they actually, they even wrote a blog reflecting on the impact that it had, because it is very, very hard to actually watch that amount of propaganda. So on the one hand, there's a very clear research need. We need to know what is going on. At the same time, it's actually very difficult to do. For you as a researcher, especially a younger researcher, to actually study these kinds of materials, because you see such ridiculous claims. It's really, really hard to do. So silver lining, you were asking for a silver lining. I'm getting far away from silver linings. I don't really know what the silver lining is. I think perhaps the silver lining is that there has been a very strong field of Russian studies. This is also quite a close community. So people know each other, people work together. There are very impressive collectives who have been working together for quite some time. So I think that that is a good, provides a good basis to try and maintain that we have a high level of knowledge, which I think is really essential moving forward. If we want to be able to respond to what Russia is doing, if we want to be able to formulate policies that will help us respond, then you do need this very fine-grained understanding of how Russia works, how society reacts, why it does not react sometimes. And I think that this this community is able to provide that. So I'm hoping that because it is such a very well-built network in a way, that it is able to actually respond and to provide that knowledge. At the same time, we do see a shift in the field, which I think is very positive, to say that, well, it has been quite silly that you have these, for example, as I mentioned, Alexandri, Russian and East European studies. It's like, why is Russia mentioned? Just really approaching an entire region by focusing on Russia alone. And then maybe you have, if you were teaching a seminar, that you would have one session on the Baltic states. Right? So you would have 10 about Russia and then one about the Baltic states. So even not mentioning them independently. And that is actually quite silly. And that we need to move away from that, that we need to make sure that we provide all these independent states with sufficient attention, that we actually study them independently. And to try and not view them from the Russian perspective, because it has colored much of the field. And I think that that is a very useful discussion that is ongoing now, that I hope also will actually lead to changes. So both in education as well as in research, that it used to be the case that, for example, if you were in political science, that they would say, well, perhaps not do this case study on Georgia because Georgia is too small. You will never get a job if you write your dissertation about Georgia or Azerbaijan. You can much better write it about Russia. I hope that that will change now, that actually these other states that are very, very worthy of independent study, that have a very different ways in which society is organized, very different challenges that they struggle with, but also very different achievements. I think we see this now with how resilient Ukraine has turned out to be, how we see that the digital policies that they have done over the past years, how an important role they have played in being so resilient. That really means that we have to study them more seriously independently. And I hope that that discussion that is now ongoing, that that will actually result in a more diverse field, which I think is very useful. So hopefully that's the silver lining that I think might might appear. But at the same time, the current situation is very, very difficult because we have an ongoing war, which is really devastating both for Ukrainian citizens, for Ukrainian academics who have to keep working and try to keep working. And then on the opposite side, you have Russian state collapse near, as well as many people who have left the country, trying to now find different places to stay, trying to find their way in exile. So there are many, many challenges on different levels. So the only thing that we can hope for is to have a positive peace in the end. But that unfortunately is not yet on the horizon. Because we see around the war that there has been so much disinformation, especially, of course, the Russian side is really very aggressive in its disinformation efforts. But what I've been very impressed in is like the building of these international networks to counter this, so that we've learned to recognize and to respond, and that you see these international collectives forming, trying to both debunk disinformation, but also to really push for justice. And I've been very impressed in how multiple communities, so for example, this open source community, OSINT community, who's been very active in fact-checking all kinds of claims and evidence. And then you have a very strong human rights community, which was very deservedly won the Nobel Peace Prize. They have been working really hard in documenting all of the human all of the atrocities that the Russian army has committed to make sure that at some point justice can be done. And I've been very impressed in the international networking and response. So this is a lot. This takes a lot of effort, but I do think that those kinds of efforts, they make me very positive that there some justice will be done in the end, which I hope will come to be.
And before I let you go, can you tell us a little bit what have you been working on right now?
So right now, as a fellow at the Helsinki Collegium for Advanced Studies, I'm working on digital sovereignty or digital dependency, actually, of authoritarian states. Since we've many authoritarian states, especially China, but also Russia, for quite some years, they've been very vocal about striving towards digital sovereignty. So to become independent, to have all of their hardware and software domestically produced, to not be dependent on any foreign supplier. But through all of my research of Russia, I always saw this big gap between, on the one hand, all of their policies and the things that they were claiming. So, for example, claiming that the Russian internet will become fully independent and we can just detach it and then it will keep on operating. And on the opposite hand, just looking at how much everything was still integrated, how dependent they were still on foreign suppliers of all kinds of things. So I saw this massive gap and I also thought, well, that is actually makes them very vulnerable. Makes them very vulnerable in terms of how they try to do their repression. So, for example, it's very difficult to force foreign social media platforms to commit censorship. That can be very difficult, but also on other types of levels. So, for example, that they are very highly dependent on Android operating systems for their mobile phones. They don't really have a very suitable domestic alternative. Same issue with like higher quality processors. On all of those levels, I thought, well, that doesn't really look like you're not dependent. And actually now that I was working on this, so trying to theorize what are the vulnerabilities that actually come from those dependencies, because the globe is so interdependent when it comes to digital infrastructures. What does that mean for how states try to control the sphere? Of course, now the war happened. And as a response, there have been sanctions have been imposed, especially also tech sanctions, but also wider sanctions that affect all elements of digital infrastructure. And especially also we've seen the departure from the Russian market of many Western IT companies. And this is really wreaking havoc across the Russian internet sector. So on the one hand, they have blocked foreign platforms. So you would say, well, that actually strengthens their capacity, for example, to censor information. At the same time, all of their ambitions, for example, in becoming very advanced in AI or just running these kinds of very extensive surveillance systems, you need servers for that. Where do those servers come from? Well, apparently not from Russia because they're deemed not good enough by Russian state authorities, right? So you see all of these tensions emerging. So that is what I'm working on mostly now. So what does this global digital interdependence, what does that actually mean for authoritarian states?
Yeah, I wish you the best of luck with your research. And despite all the challenges we've talked about, and I personally also have to say thank you, because I do take a lot of inspirations from your work and your colleagues' work. So yeah, thank you very much for the great work you've been doing. And also thank you very much for the conversation today.
Thank you for having me.
And to our listeners, you can also connect with Malia and me on Twitter and Mastodon. The links will be shared in the show notes. Thank you for listening to New Books Network podcast. See you next time.